Thanks for tuning in to Best Show Ever, a podcast presented by the Englert Theater. Today we're talking with Iowa City's own Alta Medea about her work with the Domestic Violence Intervention Program, otherwise known as DVIP. We'll be discussing the art of intervention and exploring some of its many nuances and complexities. Let me tell you a bit more about Alta, and then we'll jump into the conversation. Alta started her work to end domestic violence and build resources for victim survivors at a young age. She's worked for over 20 years strengthening her community and supporting those most vulnerable through direct action, volunteerism, service, and advocacy. She officially began her work with the Domestic Violence Intervention Program as first a volunteer, then a board member, and now Director of Community Engagement. Over the past 4 years, she has written multiple pieces on behalf of the DVIP and selected a curriculum on marketing domestic violence services called How to Make a Secret. Okay, Alta, thank you for being here and doing this podcast with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's a long time coming that we have someone from DVIP on, so I'm so glad we're making it happen. I kind of want to talk about the art of intervention, you know, through what you do. But I think it's important to start before the intervention because a lot of what DVIP does is prevention. So can you talk a little bit about what the most important resources for people to have up front are as far as preventing domestic abuse occurrences from taking place?
Yeah, I think that the biggest thing is really believing survivors and listening. The key to ending domestic violence is moving it out of the shadows and into everyday conversation. The number one way that victim survivors find out about services like the Domestic Violence Intervention Program is through word of mouth. So the more we talk about it, the more we take power from isolation that perpetrators have, abusers have, and put it into the hands of victim survivors and those supporters that are vital to keeping them safe.
What are the common warning signs, or maybe what is the most important kind of information you would like people to have up front?
Yeah, I think that it really, you know, I've been thinking about this question and how domestic violence is very secretive. Nobody sets out in a new relationship and is like, geez, I really hope I get abused by this person. Yeah. We don't ever really willingly want to give up the control over our own autonomy in our lives and our decisions. It's about, you know, falling in love. Mm-hmm. Abusers groom you and really turn on a lot of charm. One of the phrases is called love bombing. And it feels good to be loved. It feels good to have somebody want you and to take care of you. Not that always is that mean that that's an abusive relationship, right? But yeah, there is not a specific thing. It happens kind of subtly. Perhaps, you know, asking you to change the way you dress, asking you to change your hair color, asking you to not spend so much time with friends or family, really isolating you is the biggest part of that. So when we're talking with folks about how to support friends or how to, you know, pick out those red flags, listening to your intuition and encouraging people that you're a safe person to talk to, that you see them, and reaching out anyway to maintain that relationship and friendship with someone you suspect of being abused is really some of the best ways that we as a community can support each other.
I did want to ask what kind of progress we've seen on a larger scale in the United States regarding specifically the prevention of domestic abuse, be it, you know, policy or just general worldview change of people, if you can muse on that at all.
Yeah, so what's interesting is it really comes down to kids. Prevention education starts very young, talking about consent with kiddos as little as 3, that what our hands are used for, you know, they're not used for hitting, that we speak clearly about what we want and need, and just really addressing those control type of things. I think that we've seen a big movement in both, you know, secondary and junior high school age kiddos, and having those conversations during their health classes, during sex ed. We talk about relationships, not just sort of the physical piece, but that there are also emotional aspects to that, and bringing the conversation about dating violence in to young ones. That way they are helping to look out for each other and also know which adults they can turn to that are safe to have those conversations with. Mm. But to me, that is one of the bigger keys, is to move. Our youth are already having really big conversations, bigger than when I was younger. And, you know, talking about gaslighting, talking about manipulation in ways that we haven't as a country before. And I think that's vital in moving to a space in which we can end domestic violence overall.
Yeah, I do. I feel like I keep having so many moments where I'm just like, these kids are so smart. They're so woke about so many things that was not even in my purview when I was like their age. I'm like, what was I even thinking about when I was in middle school?
Exactly. My 13-year-old at dinner brought up gaslighting last night, and I was like, well, yes. You know, like, okay, we're having this conversation. But I think normalizing what a healthy relationship looks like. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the red flags in relationships, but there's also green flags in a relationship, and reminding them of what positive healthy relationships can look like is just as impactful as what not to look for.
Mm, absolutely. What do you think we are getting, or most people are getting wrong about domestic abuse?
I think that overall, we think it's someone else's problem. It would never happen to me. If it happened to me, I'd leave. I think a stigma that still really exists in our culture is, you know, well, why doesn't she just leave? And if it were that simple, people would. But the truth is that victim survivors, the most dangerous, most lethal time in their relationship is the 72 hours after they leave. What would you do if someone knew everything about you and knew how to hurt you, knew where you kept your money, where your kids were, where you'd go for safety? They have all of the access, and really keeping yourself safe is the number one thing. Individuals are stalked for up to 18 months after the relationship is over. You know, 18 months from now is a long time to really be vigilant and paying attention to every single thing that's still going on, even though you've left the relationship. So asking why someone doesn't leave is not really the question we should be asking. I think the better question is, why does the abuser think it's okay to abuse someone?
Mm-hmm. When it does come time for intervention, what does, on a macro level, that process look like?
Yeah, so obviously every situation is different. Everybody's life is different, and what they need to have safety varies from person to person. Overall, individuals use our hotline to reach out to us. Our hotline is 800-373-1043. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because you never know when somebody is going to be able to call. So we are there. We start with safety planning. Are you safe now? And building a safety plan for the immediate, and then a safety plan as things progress. So does that mean you're moving out? Does that mean that you're staying? But you need to have a safety plan for when things get out of control. And really from that point, then navigating all of the different systems that are in place. There are a lot of barriers to victim survivors' safety and ability to move forward. And so addressing each one of those with an advocate one-on-one that really matches with what you need. We often say our advocates walk alongside you. So they don't tell you what to do. We don't have a magic wand, though many of us very much wish we did. It's about, you know, translating some of that legal language, translating some of the hospital language that's used, and really helping you understand the choices that you have and giving that autonomy to the individual.
Mm. That reminds me a lot of, I've been talking a lot with friends who are doulas about just what being a doula means. And yeah, it's not about like hard legal or hard medical, you know, opinions and advice, but being with someone on that journey and providing as many resources as you can. And what a difference doing that makes, like, just literally being in that person's community can make all the difference for people in those situations. I'm curious, in Iowa City specifically, what are some of the most common barriers?
Yeah, I think, you know, housing is absolutely one of them. The cost of living is high. Many of our individuals that we serve have not had a job, have bad credit. 99% of victim survivors have experienced financial abuse, meaning they have had their, you know, identities stolen in a way, or they have had, you know, debt taken out in their names, or they've been evicted. And that's a huge barrier to overcome. On top of that, most of them have not been able to work or have had their money, you know, from their job taken away, or have been stalked and harassed at their job so often that they have no longer have that job. So there's a number of issues around that, economic and financial security, that we have to address with folks. In addition, you know, if they have kids, then it's childcare, getting them to school, transportation. Transportation is a huge barrier. You know, you can get a job in North Liberty, but you can find an affordable place to live in you know, another community. How do you get from point A to point B?
Mm-hmm.
And that is where we find ourselves really digging deep for resources and trying to help people navigate the best solutions for their situations.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but portrayal of domestic violence in media or in movies or what have you, I feel like does focus on just the moment of physical violence and doesn't really give that all-encompassing view of all the nuanced things that are happening. Would you agree that that's...
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. A lot of times when people think about domestic violence or intimate partner violence, they think of physical violence. And the truth is that there are the three main types. There is physical, there is also emotional abuse, and then there's financial abuse. And generally, all three of them occur. A lot of the clients that we serve, you know, say the bruises heal. It's the emotional trauma and those words that have been said over and over that are the hardest to really overcome. And that's why support groups, that's why moving that story from being isolated, from nobody believes you, you're completely alone, to actually there are hundreds of thousands of people that support you and are working to give you everything possible to be safe.
Yeah, that emotional aspect is something I wanted to talk about because, I don't know, to me that feels like the most difficult part to wrap my head around, because it is like these people are in love with the people who are abusing them, and that's, how do you reconcile that? And how do you be the one who walks along beside them? I'm kind of the friend who, like, it, you know, people don't call on for the serious stuff. Like, I you know, I bring the brevity or, like, the jokes or make people, you know, feel better. But I just can't even imagine, you know, coming in and trying to help someone emotionally through such a nuanced and complex relationship.
It's, I mean, it, our advocates are excellent problem solvers. If I summed up our jobs, that would be what it is. We problem solve. And active listening. You know, it's really about giving space for that story to be told and believing someone. The power of listening and believing can go a long way in helping people to heal and begin to see hope and possibility for something different.
Yeah, so it's not even about just having the right thing to say or giving the right answers.
It's most of the time, it's not saying anything. It's really about listening. And I think that as humans, we often want to have the right answer. We want to be able to, you know, solve the problem, give a solution, right? Like, well, there's a problem, here's a solution, and then we can move forward. And with things like intimate partner violence or abuse, it's not that simple. It's very much about holding space for that person. And I think one of the most powerful things that individuals can say to friends or family members that are either in abusive situations or leaving abusive situations is, I believe you, and I'm here. And that's it. And then being there and listening, and not judging, right? That's another huge part of it. On average, it takes a victim survivor 7 times to leave a situation.
Wow.
And so when we think about that, that's a lot of times of being there and watching someone go back and continually reminding them that you hear them and you see them and you believe them. There is no magic wand.
Mm. Thinking of maybe someone who is close to the situation, like a loved one who's watching their other loved one go back to an abusive relationship. I mean, what would you say to that person who maybe gets frustrated or wants to, I don't know, like give up or shut down on the situation? Because, I mean, it is such a long, arduous process that...
Yeah, I would say don't give up on them.
Yeah.
And certainly take care of yourself. If that means, you know, obviously stepping away for a little while and then reaching back out. I would say that our hotline is also available to those individuals trying to process that and figure out the best way to support someone. Mm. Our advocates are there to answer any questions. You don't have to be the primary victim to make that phone call. And sometimes just having space to talk through it gives you a little bit of space to then go back and say, I'm here.
Mm.
But consistently being open to them reaching out to you, because you never know when you could save somebody's life just by showing up.
It's crazy how much of this is just talking and being in communication with each other. And it seems so simple, but it seems like something that is just not embedded, I don't know, in our culture or something. Like, I have this group of friends, and we watch a show every Sunday called Euphoria. And the other day, we always just kind of hang out before a little bit every week, which we didn't hang out, like, consistently every week until we started watching this TV show, which is like, okay, it's... anyways, but it was funny because we were talking about different people's experience with therapists and, you know, what they like was missing with their therapist or what was, and some woman was just like, well, that's why I come here every Sunday. This is my therapy. And it was kind of like, wow, this, what we're doing right now really is kind of that therapeutic community building thing. And it's just hanging out to watch a TV show and like having conversation. And yeah, we get into like relationships and all sorts of things that I think people, yeah, just need to talk out with anyone.
Right. And we all want somebody to hear us.
Yeah.
And somebody to see us. Those are two of the most powerful things that there are.
Yeah.
And so when we're doing that for our friends, for our loved ones, and having that be reciprocated, that is incredibly powerful.
We'll be right back in conversation with Alta after a word from our development team.
If there's one thing we've all learned, it's that the future is unpredictable and uncertain, but the most reliable way to predict the future is to create it. If the future you want to create involves a thriving and innovative arts community, then you should invest in the future of the Englert through our Fellowship for the Future program. With a Fellowship for the Future gift commitment, the Englert has a stronger foundation to plan for even bigger growth. We are dedicated to investing more in our passionate staff, our innovative programming, and our diverse community. Victor Hugo once wrote, "There is nothing like a dream to create the future." And here at the Englert, we have big dreams, and we're going to be a part of an amazing future for our community. Please visit englert.org/fellowship for more information, or contact us to talk about what we can build together.
I'm curious how folks at DVIP, people who are responding in the call center, protect their own spiritual and emotional energy after like getting real hot and heavy in these intense situations day after day.
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways. I've actually been asked this question a number of times in the last couple weeks, which has been wonderful. I love that we're talking about it as a community, and just that it's become sort of an interview question that I get, because it's really important. Secondary trauma, so after hearing about the worst days and the worst things in someone's life, there is something called secondary trauma. And so we actually debrief with each other. We lean on each other as advocates. We process that information and name it. you know, right? Doing the same thing that we're saying to other people to do, right? Listen, communicate, talk about it, take it out of the shadows. So that's sort of the first point of that. The second point is we celebrate in the ridiculous absurdities of life. We all sort of have our own really silly things or very passionate things that we do. We have people that knit, we have people that cross stitch, we have a lot of people that do yoga. We have some people that do horseback riding, right? Like, however that self-care looks different for everyone. I decided that I love the Bengals football team this fall, and that's where all of my energy has gone. And like, I'm having, you know, I had a really hard call. And so then I watched Bengals highlights. Like, it just is a silly, like, whatever is sort of there to give us that space to think about something different. Mm-hmm. And we joke around a lot. We have a lot of fun. We're very much like a family. We also have our fundraisers where we get to talk to the community and listen to some of the amazing things that have happened for people and how our program has impacted them. We've been around for 42 years, so mm-hmm. we have seen a lot in that time and a lot of people grow and change throughout those years. So celebrating all of the wins that we can and supporting each other through the tears.
Mm. I love that both of those things are so intentional for y'all. And just always love talking about joy. So glad you said that. I'm kind of curious, going into, you know, this role, is it recommended for people to try and keep a more tactical mindset or a more detached mindset? Or is it imperative to emotionally attach to the situation?
That is a tough question. It's about knowing your boundaries of yourself. You know, certainly the day, like if you're too technical or tactical, there's not a lot of care or empathy that can occur, right? So you don't want to go too far that way. However, you can't bring everybody home with you either. And so it's a balancing act. It's a lot about problem solving and supporting and maintaining space, and then that self-care that we talked about. I think the individuals that go into this work go into it with the goal of helping people, and generally are there because they care about people. And that's the most important part.
I think something I've learned about people working in nonprofits, especially those working for like social services or the more intense side of things, is there's a frustration and a guilt when you can't give more. And I think people who decide to go in the nonprofit world are predisposed in their personality to just want to give everything. How do you talk to your team about like setting those boundaries? So that's something I'm still learning. And you know, I work for a super fun arts nonprofit, but it's still something I struggle with, like the guilt of not doing more all the time.
Right. That's a great question. For me personally, I struggle with that. You know, yeah. I'd be like, I did this, but that's not enough. There's so much work to be done. And there is. One of my bosses, our assistant executive director, likes to remind me that it's a marathon, not a sprint. There will always be people to help. Mm-hmm. So we help the ones that we can. One of the things with my team, so the community engagement team, that we started doing during COVID, because we are so sort of removed from our daily sort of space. And so during our Wednesday morning meetings, we started talking about the successes, the wins, like how what we did actually did impact somebody, and less about what hasn't happened yet, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that we can't do because of the COVID pandemic, but there are a lot of things we've done anyway, and how those successes are redefined now at a point where we're looking at a 25% budget cut this year on the federal level, when we're looking at needing to increase our services, you know, we've had a doubling of services provided to individuals in Johnson County alone, and we serve 8 counties in southeastern Iowa. So lethality has gone up. There's a lot of challenges and a lot of things that we could do or need done, and we will do as many of them as we can, and really focusing on celebrating the stuff that has happened.
Mm. How do you engage with the politicization of the services you provide?
Yeah, it's interesting. Domestic violence has actually traditionally been a nonpartisan issue. You know, the Violence Against Women Act in 1993 was a bipartisan. This is not a partisan issue. And I think redirecting and reminding folks that it is across the board. There's no, you know, men, women, non-binary, you know, no matter your sexual orientation, your economic level, your race, it affects everybody. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 6 men are affected by domestic violence in their lifetime. And it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, or if you don't vote or if you do vote, domestic violence affects you. And so when we talk with legislators, when we work with educating the public and those that are elected officials about what they're doing and how that impacts victim survivors, we don't choose sides. You know, Joni Ernst has done some amazing work for victim survivors as of late, and that's important to note, you know, just as much as the Biden administration is to denote what they've done. So it takes all of us, mm-hmm. and if we are going to, you know, change that conversation and give power to victim survivors, that means that we have to approach everyone equally.
Mm. What is something that you would like to see happen next? Policy or otherwise local?
I would love to be fully funded. Makes sense. If I get a magic wand, I would love to see, you know, programs across the state of Iowa, but really across the country, be fully funded. The amazing work that could be done if programs weren't struggling to just keep lights on and doors open would be huge. There are a lot of brilliant problem solvers across the country doing this work, and we chat with each other. We have those conversations, but it really comes down to, you know, there's no money for transportation. How do we get an individual in northern Wisconsin, you know, to our program here because it would be safer? There's no magic transportation route or funding available to necessarily make that happen in the ways that I think could really benefit victim survivors.
Broadly speaking, how far are we from being fully funded, and have we ever been close?
I mean, I would say no, we've never been close. I would say that is, you know, that's one of those big dreams that is like, ooh, what would that number look like? You know, because there's so much need.
Yeah.
From May of 2020 to date, so each month since then, we've had a 20% increase in hotline calls each month of new calls. So what does that look like as we see our need and the need for DV services double? You know, we're full 365 days out of the year. That's over 1,900 people were served in our area. And it's like trying to think, okay, well, if we could serve everybody, if we could, I don't know what that would look like, because it also then, do we get to include prevention education into that plan? Do we get to include public service announcements and awareness campaigns and billboards? Like what, you know, what would that number look like? Those are all the things that I would consider to be fully funded to look like, not only in a, you know, emergency response, but a campus for people with trauma to be able to heal and process what they've gone through, plus then educating people on how to prevent it from happening.
Yeah. We sort of touched on this a teeny bit earlier, but my last question before we go into your best show ever is, what role do you see art playing in the work that you do?
Oh, so many ways. I love that question. So we have a youth department, mm-hmm. and we do a lot of work with our youth on letting kids be kids and playing. A lot of times children have to take on an adult role in abusive situations, mm-hmm. or the dynamics are different. And so we really give them space to play. Shortly, so it would have been the October of 2019, we were actually able to do an art show of some of their work during Gallery Walk here in Iowa City and showcase some of their work. I actually have one of the pieces from that show framed on my wall that was made by a kid that had never painted before and fell in love with using painting as a way to process her abuse. Wow. And just seeing it in that way, being able to share those experiences, having them come to the Nutcracker here at the Englert, giving them opportunities that they wouldn't have had otherwise, is a huge part of how art is helping kiddos heal and just explore different things to give them hope and enjoy. I think for our staff, we have a ton of incredibly artistic staff members. That's how we sort of do our self-care, comes down to that as well. And then the power of storytelling. Mm-hmm. One of the projects that we're working on for next fall is doing a writing, sort of generative writing workshop space for individuals to tell their survivor stories. The more that we talk about it, the more power we have. And so using both spoken word and writing and music as a way to expand how we're healing as a community and how individuals are healing is more than impactful.
Of course, I get emotional at the part where we talk about art and kids and all that good stuff. Thank you for that. Okay, well, you know, to talk about art and joy, tell us about your best show ever, your favorite live event experience in Iowa City.
There's a number of amazing events that stick out. One of them was the Dawes performance here a few years ago. I love them. They're one of my favorites overall. And so that was incredible. A friend of mine gifted me tickets to it. So it was just, and also babysat my kids. So it was like amazing, amazing in all sorts of ways of our community just being beautiful. And then another one I was thinking of just now was Puddle's Pity Party. That performance, we were gifted some tickets at DVIP for staff to use, and I was able to come with that, and I had no idea what I was in for, and I laughed and cried, and it was amazing. And so I'd say those are a couple of them, but there are so, so many. Being part of the Green Room series that the university and the Englert had in partnership, I was able to speak on behalf of DVIP and open for DESA, and that was absolutely incredible. Mm. There's just so, so, so many different things. The arts are super important to me, so there is that piece of it too.
Yeah. Oh, there's something so special about being gifted. I know. It just makes the whole thing different. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to do this with us. We so appreciate, on behalf of the Englert, all the stuff that you and your team do for our community. So.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Consider supporting vulnerable women, children, and men in our region and donate to DVIP today. Visit dvipiowa.org/donate for more information. Support for this podcast comes from Friends of the Englert and Fellowship for the Future members. Learn more at englert.org/friends. Ongoing support is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Iowa Arts Council. Our intro music is Free the Bull by Dan Padley, and our interstitial music is provided by Iowa City jazz fusion group Wavecage.